on how agriculture and natural resources, and I'm sure many of the committee members will join us. We're going to start. It's an informational meeting, so we'll get started. And Representative Roblin is asked to be excused today. He's going to speak for Senator Verger, who is quite ill, and we send our well wishes to her. We're going to start. We're going to make a few changes in the agenda. We're going to have the overview from the Governor's Natural Resource Office go first, and I believe we have Mr. Carey and Mr. Myron here. If you want to come forward and set up, thank you. I'm sure we'll have committee members joining us.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you for graciously allowing me to go first this morning and accommodating my schedule. For the record, my name is Mike Carrier. I'm the Governor's Natural Resources Policy Director, and with me is one of my staff, Jim Myron, who is a Natural Resources Advisor. I will be brief this morning because you will be hearing from a number of agency directors who I have a high regard for, and I think you will develop a high regard for their expertise, their knowledge, their experience, and their passion for what they do. It's just an incredible source of pride for me to be able to work with these folks and to provide some direction and guidance to them, although I find more often than not I take my direction and guidance from them. I wanted to talk to you first about the Governor's Natural Resources Office, its purpose, and then how it's organized, and allow some time for you to ask questions about some of the nuances of our operation. The purpose of the Governor's Natural Resource Policy Office is, of course, to develop and implement the Governor's Natural Resource Policy positions. We also serve as a liaison to you, the legislature, on natural resource issues and environmental issues. We are also a liaison with the state natural resource agencies, as well as other agencies on natural resource policy. For example, economic development, transportation, the military department. We play a key role in developing the governor's budget recommendations for the natural resource agencies. We also serve as a liaison with other stakeholder groups, which can include natural resource dependent industries, environmental groups, and other units of government. We interact on a regular basis with local government, federal government, and other states. We function to coordinate the planning, the analysis, the comment, or many times the negotiations representing Oregon's interest on natural resource and environmental issues that either span the interest and purview of several agencies and where it's not appropriate that one single agency take the lead, or in cases where the relationship involves other states and a number of federal agencies. And there's probably no better example of that than the Klamath Basin issues. I'll just talk briefly about the organization of our office. I serve as the Governor's Natural Resource Policy Director and the Staff Director of the office. I have two permanent Natural Resource Advisor positions and two positions that are limited duration. We do a significant workload covering dozens and dozens of issues, which gives me a lot of gratification because I like the diversity of that. But we seem to spend more time working on fish and wildlife issues, water issues, forestry, energy, and sustainability, and the Willamette River issues. I want to mention at this point that perhaps this is somewhat of a departure from the previous administration. We strive to work very, very closely with the natural resource agencies that you're going to be hearing from today and probably in other hearings on policy development. We hope to be seamless in the development and implementation of policy decisions, and as a result, we have a close relationship with the directors and the staff of the various natural resource agencies. And there's something on the order of, and these are not all agencies, some are boards or commissions like the Public Utilities Commission or the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, but we have about 16 to 17 entities that sit on what we call our natural resource cabinet every 2 weeks that meets and talks about issues of common concern. Why do we want to have that close relationship and communication with those agencies? Well, first of all, it ensures consistency throughout the executive branch as to the policy positions we take. Of course, it eliminates duplication of effort. And most importantly, and I hear this frequently from other stakeholders and other entities that we deal with, it's really important on natural resources, it's important on any issue, that Oregon speaks with one voice. And that's what we strive to do in this office, is to ensure that when a position is being taken on a natural resource issue, that we are representing Oregon's interest and speaking with one voice. Well, with that, Madam Chair, I would be very happy to answer any questions that the committee has. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ryland, did you want to add anything?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Jim Meyer, and Governor's Natural Resource Policy Advisor. I think Mike has done an excellent job in giving you an overview of what our office does. I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions that anybody has, and either now or later, feel free to contact us at any time if issues come up that you want to have any explanation of where the governor's office is on those issues. So. Thank you.
I had one question for Mr. Carey. You said that the governor's office's position of Oregon's one voice. How do you get to that decision of one voice? We hear from many voices.
Well, when I'm talking about one voice, I'll give you an example on relicensing a hydropower license, which is, you know, there's a state process and a federal process, and in dealing with the many federal agencies and other stakeholders, they are very eager to assure that when Oregon's natural resource agencies participate, that there's been coordination and a resolution of any differences between agency positions before we get to that level of negotiation. And that's what I mean about speaking with one voice.
And you're speaking about agencies one voice.
Correct. I don't pretend to represent the diverse stakeholders of natural resource issues in Oregon, just the natural resource agencies within the executive branch.
Great. Any other questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Burley.
Thank you for being here today. And pretty much along those lines, I was actually encouraged with the governor's State of the State address last week when he recognized that timber and agriculture are essential to Oregon's economy. And for many of our rural communities, timber and agriculture is the economy. And with about 16 million acres of national forest lands in Oregon, and for many of these rural communities and counties that rely on timber and agriculture, these federal lands are the vast majority of the land base. But I'm having a little difficulty reconciling the governor's comments last week with what appears to be his position that we should be locking up nearly 2 million acres of roadless area. On July 16 last year, the Forest Service published a rule that proposed rule that provides for petitioning process to give the governors an opportunity to seek establishment of management requirements for national forest system inventory roadless areas within their states. This process would allow the state to collaborate with local governments, stakeholders, and other interested parties to develop proposals that consider a full range of public input on how these roadless areas should be managed. So what I'm curious, and it's along these lines of the coordination, if this rule becomes final, and I know the governor went on record opposing it, what are the plans in Oregon to take advantage of the petitioning process? How will we effectively collaborate with local governments, stakeholders, and other interested parties to consider a full range of public input on how roadless areas should be managed?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, thank you for asking that question. And I know that your position on management and utilization of fiber off roadless areas may differ somewhat from the governor's, and I appreciate you acknowledging his recognition of the importance of the forest industry and agriculture to much of rural Oregon. With regard to the specific question about if the 2004, I guess we'll call it the 2004 roadless rule that the administration proposed and the governor lined up against, is adopted or promulgated and then sent to the states to undertake this process, the governor has made it very clear that he intends that the Board of Forestry and the state forester will be the principal source of forest policy direction for Oregon, including the governor's office, not only with regard to state forest lands and private forest lands, but also with regard to federal forest lands. So we will make the rule, despite the fact that there are some components of the rule that we don't like, and I'll tell you specifically what they are, we will make that rule work in the best interest of Oregon, and we will do it through the Board of Forestry and the State Forester. Have we designed a process for public hearings and taking comment and evaluating areas for potential rural districts? No, we haven't started that process yet. We're still waiting for the federal rule to come down, and then we have a number of months, as you well know, to go through that process. The governor's concern about the 2004 roadless rule was not the idea of the state having a major role, because that's what he called for in 2002, shortly after his election, a major role in federal forest land policy and management. His concern about the rule is it requires the state and the governor to go through this extensive public process to identify and then petition the federal government as to which portions of the national forest system in their state should be roadless, and offers absolutely no assurance that those recommendations of the governor will be adopted by the federal agency, nor does it give the state any key stakeholder or meaningful role in the future management of those lands. And that was his principal concern about the rule, and it remains his concern. Along those lines, we're working closely with the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management to bring state agencies in as cooperating partners on future management planning for both BLM lands and the National Forest lands.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes,
may not be the place of time, but I too have concerns, and I got on the record about this one voice concept. Proclamations by speeches and decisions of legal actions and things like that. One voice to me is a unity effort, and individual efforts don't equal one voice, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments? Or? I don't think we do. I just wanted you to come and give us an overview, and I'm sure we'll have you back in front of this committee, or you'll want to be back. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We look forward to coming back.
Okay. Thank you. We now have Katie Koba, the Director of Department of Ag, and Chuck Cray, the Deputy Director. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for allowing us to make a change in the agenda.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Katie Koba, and I'm the Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And with me this morning is Chuck Craig, who is our deputy. So in a short period of time, we're going to try to give you an overview of the agency and the myriad of programs that we oversee. You have a packet in front of you that I'd like to draw your attention to. And within that packet, you have a two-page document titled Oregon Department of Agriculture Testimony Prepared for the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee, and I'm going to speak to that first, and so I would ask you to follow along, and then I'm going to refer you to our draft biennial report that has a lot of information about the agency. I certainly won't go through it in detail, but it will be available for your future reference. The Department of Agriculture was created in 1931 and began operations, interestingly enough, in the turmoil of the Great Depression on July 1, 1931. The duties and statutes of more than a dozen previous agricultural boards and commissions were combined in Oregon statutes. And at that time, the department was created with six divisions, including food and dairies, animal industries, plant industry, state fair, market enforcement, and administration. And as we get to a little later in my presentation, you'll see that we are now a nine-division agency. Several of the divisions are similar to those that were created in 1931. The fundamental duties of the department and its structure are now found in ORS 561, and we collaborate and work very closely with Oregon State University, which we view as a very integral partner in dealing with the challenges that we face in production agriculture in the state here today. The department's mission statement has evolved over time, but it's pretty much carried on in terms of the theme that you see now, and we have a threefold mission statement that includes promoting the economic viability of the industry through marketing, inspection, certification, health programs, keeping plant and diseases out of the state. Secondly, protecting and enhancing the natural resource base, which all Oregon agricultural production relies upon. And critically, the issues of land and water. And third, providing consumer safety and protection through food safety and inspection programs, our weights and measures program, and quality assurance and standards. We view this mission statement as being very interdependent, and a number of our programs contribute to one or more segments of our mission statement. At the bottom of the page, you'll notice that we view the Department of Agriculture as a medium-sized agency. Our current biennial budget is $76.9 million, comprised of approximately 15% in general fund, 68% of other funds, which is primarily fees and assessment services that we provide, 10% in lottery funds, and 7% in federal funds. And as I mentioned, we are currently divided into 9 divisions that oversee 36 chapters of Oregon law. I think if there's one thing that I would have you take away this morning from our presentation is, first of all, the agriculture industry in Oregon is extremely diverse, and the Department of Agriculture is extremely diverse. So if I could, I'd like to ask you to look at our biennial report, which we're just finalizing. So we gave you a draft format to follow through this morning. And if you'll turn to page 4, you'll see that we have a strategic roadmap for the Oregon Department of Agriculture and 6 sections in our roadmap. And this correlates again to key areas that we work on and our mission statement. The first area is helping agriculture succeed economically. And certainly the viability of agriculture in this state and the ability to add value to agriculture production is critically important to the industry, and it's a very important part of what we do in the agency. We have a marketing division which helps the industry here in the state move its products both domestically and internationally. Markets for Oregon agriculture are absolutely critical. 80% of what we produce in this state leaves our state's borders. Over 40% of that moves internationally. And so for us, maintaining the markets that we have and constantly looking for new market opportunities for Oregon agricultural products is absolutely critical. During the past biennium, we have been involved in a number of activities related to marketing. We've been involved in the Brand Oregon campaign, in particular Oregon Wild promoting seafood products, and Oregon Bounty this last fall, which was a combination of wine, hazelnuts, pears, and cheese products here in the state of Oregon. And we think there's a lot of potential in the future for Brand Oregon and Oregon agricultural products. Our marketing program has been recognized nationally as one of the best marketing programs in the United States. We are constantly working with the industry to move products domestically and internationally. In the past biennium, we focused on grass seed into China, Oregon nursery products into Japan, and now expanding into China, wine products into our international markets as well. And we also work on bringing foreign buyers into the state of Oregon and matching them up with producers here to explore marketing opportunities. Our marketing division is located in Portland in the Food Innovation Center. It's co-located with Oregon State University, and in that facility we work to constantly identify ways to add value to Oregon products through packaging, labeling, new product development, and we've had some exciting things happen in the past biennium in that area as well. Switching to the second area, helping Oregon agriculture succeed environmentally. For us, the natural resource base is critically important to our viability in agriculture production. The number of programs that we have in our agency, again, dealing with the environment is expansive. In the past biennium, we have successfully completed 39 water quality management plans all around the state. This is under our Senate Bill 1010 program. Some of you may have heard of that. We've been under process now for nearly 10 years working on implementing, developing those plans, and now we're shifting into the implementation side, working very closely with the producers on the ground to do that. We operate the confined animal feeding operations for livestock operations in the state. We certainly have a strong interest in land use issues and what's going on with Measure 37 and maintaining the viability of production agriculture in Oregon. We regulate the use of pesticides to protect people and the environment from adverse effects and make sure that our producers have the tools available for their use in terms of pesticides. And we also oversee Oregon's 45 soil and water conservation districts and work with them, and they work very closely with us in implementing the water quality efforts that we have going around the state, among other issues. Our third strategic area, responding to pests, diseases, and other threats to agriculture. This has probably been the most high-profile area that we've had in the current biennium, dealing with the outbreak of BSE in the livestock industry, as well as high-profile disease in the nursery industry, sudden oak death. And I would say to you that more and more with the global economy, diseases are going to be a threat to our industry, and it's a very important part of what we do. It's not just these high-profile diseases. Some of you may remember the gypsy moth infestation nearly 20 years ago that had a very serious impact on our forest industry. We continue to monitor gypsy moths in this state, Japanese beetles, other plant pests, noxious weeds, those kinds of things, which all pose a threat to Oregon agriculture and its viability. In this area, we also monitor livestock theft, and with the recent increase in cattle prices, we've also seen, interestingly enough, recent increases in at least attempts for livestock theft in the state. Moving on to page 6. Number 4, ensuring safe food and protecting Oregon's consumers. The Department of Agriculture has the Food Safety Program, which conducts food safety inspections in grocery stores, in food processing facilities, meat packing facilities, and dairy plants. Probably our number one most important program, ensuring the safety of the food supply for consumers. Again, I think that became more of a high-profile issue than perhaps it had been with the outbreak of BSE and the potential implications in food safety. But there are a number of ongoing threats in food safety that we monitor and try to keep out of the food supply, both to protect consumers but to ensure the quality of the products that we produce here in Oregon. E. coli, salmonella, other kinds of things that consumers are very concerned about. We also have the Measurement Standards Division in our agency, which ensures fuel quality. We are the ones that make sure that the scales in grocery stores are accurate. And we also, interestingly enough, calibrate the ping pong balls that are used in the lottery drawings. So, again, another example of how diverse our agency is.
We haven't won yet.
Are you paid for that?
We are paid for that, yes. Fifth, making it easier to do business with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, as well as on the next page, serving the regulated community. How we do our business is very, very important to us. Interestingly enough, we are one of the few agencies in state government charged with both promoting the economic viability of an industry at the same time as we regulate it. And it creates an interesting tension as we go about our work. But frankly, I believe that tension is very, very good and is the appropriate way to go about delivering state government services. We are committed to providing good customer service, to providing technical assistance to the industry. If we see a problem, we don't just point out the problem, but we are there to try to help the industry deal with that problem. And we do conduct periodic customer service surveys to make sure we're getting feedback from those that we are serving. We're very involved in the governor's efforts around regulatory streamlining. We've done a thorough review of our administrative rules. We've eliminated a number of rules, and we've done that in concert with those who are affected by the rules, asking for their input as we do that. For us, regulatory streamlining is an ongoing effort. It's not just a one-time thing. And finally, we are in essence, have a Board of Agriculture. You will probably see before you this legislative session a bill which moves our Board of Agriculture from being an advisory body to a policymaking body, and we think this is very important for the board and for the industry in a way to try to unify the industry and provide more of a unified voice for agriculture issues and concerns in the state. On page 8, you will see the list of our Board of Ag members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick question about your strategic roadmap, and I probably should know this. Is this something you have been continuously doing, or is this a new process for you? Has it changed much if you've been doing it?
Madam Chair, Representative Beyer, this is a document that was in place probably initially about 5 years ago, in place before I came to the agency 2 years ago, and then we obviously constantly updated, and the version that you see is our most recently updated version.
And I guess as a quick follow-up, are there any big substantial changes over past documents?
Madam Chair, Representative Beyer, no, nothing substantial. We've not had reorganization in the agency, no major new programs in the agency. It's pretty much work as usual and doing the job that we need to do to support and help the industry succeed.
And one more quick follow-up,
okay.
Sorry. And the streamlining piece, is that more recent than the rest of it, or
Madam Chair,
recent,
or? Madam Chair, Representative Beyer, we did add that section on streamlining because obviously that's a priority for the governor, the administration, and all state agencies. But as I mentioned, streamlining to us is not a one-time thing. It's something that we take very seriously and had been doing prior to the focus, and certainly took a very hard look at the work that we do and how we do it and how we can do that better, and that's something that is very important to us and we will do ongoing.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. I have a quick question on the same thing. Can you give me an example of a rule that you have streamlined that you changed? Because you talk in general terms about how you've done this. I just want to see.
Madam Chair, all of the divisions were asked to review all of their rules and identify potential rules that could be taken off the books or things that could be updated and improved. I know of a number of rules that were eliminated. One example that I could speak to would be in our plant division, where the board actually just reviewed 18 different rules that were updated in terms of terminology. Some of the work that we do has shifted a little bit. So that language was updated. And in the process of reviewing that, the division worked closely with the industry, made sure they agreed with the direction that we were going, with the terminology that we were using. We actually had proposed some rules to be eliminated, and the industry came back and said, no, we don't want those eliminated. So that was interesting to us as well. I don't know, Chuck, if you have something to add.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Chuck Craig, Deputy with Ag. I think one example that I could give is in the confined animal feeding operations program. Operators make applications to us for a permit to operate what we affectionately call a CAFO. And for a long time, we required detailed plans to be submitted to us to be reviewed as far as the waste management system for the CAFO, and we were actually the entity that reviewed those in detail and approved them or disapproved them. We've streamlined that process so that a person can submit an application that's been pre-certified by a certified engineer as meeting our standards. So that's the kind of thing that we've been working on.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. The food inspection program is funded by permit fees. Correct me if I get the terminology wrong. And I understand there's been some discussion about that recently. What's the status of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, our food safety program historically has been funded by a combination of general fund and license fees. The last fee increase that we had in the program was in 1987, and through the 90s we saw a growth in the terms of numbers of establishments that we had. Our license fee revenue increased, and we actually built up a fairly healthy ending balance in that program. And then towards the end of the 90s, we saw some changes in the industry, some of our costs that increase in terms of personnel costs is primarily driven by employees that conduct the inspections. We began to see a decline in terms of the ending balance, so we were eating down the ending balance, but we still had the general fund support in the agency. About 30% general fund, 70% fee supported. As we got into the budget difficulties with the state and into the special sessions, general fund was taken out of that program a number of different times, and we were directed to continue to eat off the ending balance and really try to eliminate the ending balance. As a result of that, this current biennium, we are funded about 5% general fund, 95% fee support. And by the end of this biennium, we will have a very small ending balance in the program. In order to continue the operation of the program at the level that's been approved by the legislature, we would need to probably double the license fees in that program. Obviously, this has caught the attention of the industry and raised concerns. So we've been in a series of meetings with the industry over the past 6 months to try to figure out how to address this issue. We've got a number of options that we'll be laying out before the legislature. I think the biggest challenge is, unless there's an infusion of general fund back into the program, we are looking at pretty significant fee increases to keep the program operational.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, really that wraps it up. The rest of, I think, page 9 in the Biennial Report is a very interesting page. Talks about a number of the issues that we've been working on in this current biennium. And then the rest of the document actually goes into identified divisions with the agency, and I don't feel that I need to go into that detail. You have it. You can read it at your leisure, but certainly if there's any additional questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Pass.
Thank you, Katie. I think you and your agency have done a great job at integrating Brand Oregon and promoting buy local, and I'm just wondering if you think there's more to do on that end, whether you need legislation or if it's a financial thing, and, or have we sort of maxed out the return on that. When I travel, I see other states, interestingly enough, New Jersey, which has a very ambitious buy local plan, and I'm just, you know, wondering if there's more to do there.
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, you're correct. The Brand Oregon program for agriculture, some connections with tourism, particularly the Oregon Bounty Campaign and promoting wineries in the state and Oregon food products, very popular, very, very good, I think, for Oregon agriculture. And you mentioned the New Jersey program, Jersey Fresh. California also has a California-grown program, as do a number of other states. Interestingly enough, I believe California spent something on the magnitude of $32 million just within the last couple years on their California-grown program. The state of Oregon public funds invested is probably about $500,000 to support the Brand Oregon effort, and we've been very fortunate to have private interest come and contribute to that as well. We don't have the resource, needless to say, to compare to the investments made in California. I think additional resources would certainly help. I don't know that there's that much available within the public sector. We'd like to see a little bit, because then that gives us the impetus to go to the private sector and say, you know, would you come on board and work with us and make investments in this program? So I'm hopeful that we can identify some public resource to keep that program going, and I think it would continue to be beneficial for agriculture, for tourism, for our business recruitment and retention efforts in the state. In terms of buy local, there's certainly a very strong connection there. I don't believe we need legislation necessarily. The Board of Ag in this current biennium has taken a strong interest in that. One of the biggest challenges that we face, frankly, is identifying product that is grown in Oregon through the wholesale and retail chain. And that is something that the board is working on, and I think administratively we may be able to make improvements there so that when you go in your grocery store, you can actually see something that's grown in Oregon, and I think consumers here in the state like that and have shown to support that effort. So that's something ongoing and very important for us, and we think some additional potential there as well.
Thank you.
Great. Representative Sumner had a question.
Yes, Ms. Koba. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for being here, and I'd like to relay to you that my constituents, the people who live in my district, are extremely interested in which direction agriculture goes in the state. And for that purpose, I look forward to working real close with you. We're proud that at any place in the United States and around the world where you see a beautiful green lawn, chances are good the seed came from my district. We're very proud that we raise almost 100% of filbert. Used to be filbert. Mm-hmm. It's hazelnuts now, and it sells much better. We're proud that people are finding out. We're very proud that people are finding out that Marionberry is not the ex-mayor of Washington, D.C. It's a very delicious berry that's unique to our district. And I want to say that Oregon farms and Oregon farm families need to remain viable. They need to remain profitable so that everyone in this state will enjoy the profits from these farms. And I look forward to working with you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, you're welcome.
Madam Chair, Representative Sumner, I couldn't agree with you more. And interestingly enough, Oregon grass seed has 60% of the Chinese market right now. So
grass seed from Oregon is going to be used in the Olympic Games in 2008 in China.
Mm-hmm.
And we can all be proud of that. Mm-hmm. Our farmers made that happen.
Do we need a field trip to go see that?
I had one quick question, and maybe we're going to hear more about it later. You talked about the change of the Board of Agriculture, and we're going to have legislative. Is it something you should comment on now, or will we be hearing that later on? Because my question is, I'm curious why we would need to make that change.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I'm assuming that legislation will come to your committee, so certainly you will hear more about it later on. This is an issue that the board has spent a lot of time in during this past 2 years. We had a work group that worked on this topic and worked very closely with the industry as well. And initially the concept came to us, the question was, should the Board of Agriculture become rulemaking? Because most of the boards and commissions in the natural resources area do have rulemaking authority. The Board of Forestry, Water Resources, Environmental Quality Commission, LCDC. Just a few of the examples. In the Department of Agriculture, the rulemaking authority rests in the position of the director. And we have brought the board and gotten them much more involved in our key rulemaking efforts, but again, that the ultimate decision resides in the position of the director. After much discussion with industry, I think we felt that we didn't want to take the board to that step in terms of being rulemaking, but there was a next step above advisory, and that is in terms of policy making. And obviously the issues that we're dealing with in the agricultural community have been critical over the past number of years, continue to be critical. And because of the diversity of the industry, it's sometimes challenging to get the industry to come together around some of these issues. And we think that the Board of Agriculture could play a role in helping to pull the various diverse segments of the industry together. That's not to say that it's going to take the place of any of the active groups that represent the agency, but certainly a facilitating place and a place where some of these key issues can come together and be discussed by the industry and consumers and those who are interested in these issues.
Okay, I think you answered it very well. Stay tuned, huh? Mm-hmm. Thank you. I was going to say it should be in the legislature. You think it's challenging? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, now we have Lindsay Bowl and Roy Elliker, Fish and Wildlife. Good morning. And as you can tell, we're kind of warming up. Good morning. Is Roy with you? No.
Good morning, Chair Smith, members of the committee. My name is Lindsey Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I appreciate this opportunity today. Today I'll be talking about the purpose of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, what the agency does, and how the department is funded, and then the statistical information on economic and participation values in the state of Oregon as it reflects on fish and wildlife. First, I think to set the foundation, I want to refer to two statutes that we have that provide us guidance. One is the wildlife policy of the state, ORS 496-012, which you will find attached to your handout today, as well as the food fish management policy, ORS 506-109. They are the primary statutes that govern the management of fish and wildlife resources in this state. These two statutes provide direction to the agency in the fulfillment of its responsibilities, and over the years, our legislature and public have invested much time and discussion striking a balance between utilization and conservation of our fish and wildlife resources. The department staffs 25 district and field offices that provide service to the public. It operates 34 hatcheries and manages 16 wildlife areas with 1,099 legislative approved full-time employees. In addition, the Oregon State Police provides a key role in delivering fish and wildlife law enforcement services in support of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Portions of license and tag revenues are used to support the enforcement effort by the Oregon State Police. We have a 7-member commission appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. The commission employs the director and hires the director and sets policy and direction for the department. The commission also adopts administrative rules that sets methods, seasons, and bag limits with respect to harvest of our fish and wildlife resources. As the director, I oversee the administration and the day-to-day operations of the department. To move into program areas, there are two major divisions in this agency. In fact, they are outlined in statute that there will be a fish division and a wildlife division of this department, which I think is somewhat unique in many state agencies, but the legislature felt that it was so important that there be two distinct divisions in this agency. They laid it out in statute that there will be a fish division and a wildlife division. And then the other divisions of the agency are at the discretion of the director. The fish division manages, conserves, and enhances Oregon's fishery resources, and they are divided into four areas. One is natural production, propagation, marine resources, and interjurisdictional fisheries. And I'll go on to explain a little bit about each one of those. The natural production program implements the development of fish conservation and management plans for fish recovery and their habitats. The program also establishes sport and commercial fishing seasons and associated regulations. The propagation program produces fish at hatchery facilities statewide to augment natural production and provide fish for sport and commercial opportunities. The program monitors fish health and through department programs, private rearing, research facilities, and natural environment. The Marine Resources Program develops and implements Oregon's marine commercial and recreational fishery management programs. And the Interjurisdictional Fisheries Program represents Oregon on regional and international fisheries management councils. Predominantly, this is a section that works with the Columbia River system, where those fish migrate out of state as far away as Idaho through Oregon into the ocean waters and all the way to Alaska and back and elsewhere. In the wildlife program, the Wildlife Division manages Oregon's wildlife by providing recreational and ecological benefits and regulating wildlife populations in a manner compatible with the primary uses of our lands. The game program establishes hunting seasons and associated regulations as it relates to big game and game bird populations. The program works with landowners to prevent and reduce wildlife damage to agricultural and timber products. The Federal Aid and Landowner Assistance Program within the Wildlife Division provides hunting access through cooperative partnerships with private landowners and federal agencies and provides assistance to landowners with a variety of programs to enhance habitat on private lands. The Wildlife Diversity Program oversees and manages non-game species within the state, which comprise 88% of our wildlife. Oftentimes we think of wildlife as deer and elk and such, but there's really 88% of wildlife is non-game related. To assist me in the administration of the agency, we have administration divided into four areas: human resources, information and education, which is your hunter education, angler education, becoming an outdoor women's program, as well as all of our public media and public relations programs. Information systems, which coordinates all of the controlled hunts and point of sale systems in the department, as well as the infrastructure of communication within the agency. And administrative services, which takes care of the budgeting, the accounting, and also the procurement within the agency. And within the administration budget, the department also includes, we also include the director's office and the Fish and Wildlife Commission. Revenue sources. Funding comes to the agency in the way of federal funds, other funds, and general fund. The budget is approximately made up of 45% other funds, which come from license and tag sales, 40% comes from federal funds, and 5% comes from general fund. And most of the general fund money is in our state-operated hatchery program. The federal funds are made up of Pittman-Robertson monies, which is a sales tax on hunting supplies, Dingell-Johnson, which is a sales tax, excise tax on angling equipment. And there are also mitigation monies that come to the agency for loss of fish and habitats associated with hydroelectric projects.
Mr. Bell, is that where the BPA funds are?
Chair Smith, that is correct.
And how much do you get per year from BPA?
If I recall correctly, now please, you have to understand I'm going by memory here, and there's all kinds of budget sources, but I believe there's about $13 million that comes from the BPA-funded programs within the Columbia Basin to the state of Oregon. And I believe that total amount of BPA money in the basin is $139 million. But I could be wrong. I would want to check to verify those figures.
Yeah, maybe you could provide me with that.
Sure.
And that's an ongoing, there are projects that are ongoing.
Those projects are reviewed on an annual basis. The first review of that is from an internal review when this agency proposes projects under the BPA contract. That then goes to the Columbia Basin Fish and Wildlife Authority. I'll make sure I get all my steps here. There's about four steps in this process. It goes to the Columbia Basin Fish and Wildlife Authority, and they then go through a review among all of the interested parties in the Columbia Basin from the four states of Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. That then goes to a peer review, as I recall, made up of scientists to determine what projects would be most beneficial and priority based in the basin. Then it goes to the Power Planning and Conservation Council central staff for another review, and then it goes to the Power Planning Conservation Council for a vote, and then it goes to BPA for final approval. I believe that's okay. I believe I've caught every step in that process. It's quite extensive.
It sounds like it. Thank you. We'll continue unless there's other questions. Go ahead.
Now, based on a 2001 national survey, which is the last survey we've had on as it relates to values related to fish and wildlife recreation in the state of Oregon, there were 8.7 million days for all species contributing for angling, contributing to $733.4 million to Oregon's economy. And if you stop to think about this, that is 8.7 million recreation days when someone went fishing in the state of Oregon. That's a lot of days when you start adding it all up. There are 657,000 licensed anglers in the state, 280,000 licensed hunters in the state. And hunters spent 2.9 million recreation days out hunting in Oregon, and they generated $481 million of personal income in their activities. And between anglers and hunters, anglers contributed $23.5 million to the general fund of the state, as hunters contributed $15.7 million of general fund to the state. And in addition to that, commercial fishing generated $16 million of general fund to the state. In reverse, this agency in the 03-05 biennium received $10.5 million of general fund to help fund these programs. I say fish and wildlife is big business in the state of Oregon, and it means much to a lot of people. In addition to hunting and fishing, there are a lot of people who pursue wildlife viewing activities, which also generated $769.4 million worth of expenditures in the state of Oregon. A new program that was implemented this last January 1 as a result of actions taken by the 03 legislative session was a requirement for a shellfish license. The shellfish license sales started January 1. The revenues from that support testing by the Oregon Department of Agriculture for toxic waste or toxicity of clams and shellfish and crab. That the sale of licenses to the shellfish program exceeded our expectations. We felt that there would be about $600,000 generated as a result of that license. Today, there is over $1 million in the account of the shellfish license sale. That money also pays for enforcement and management of a shellfish program within this agency. The money also that is generated over the $600,000 rolls into a rainy day fund that was created for that program in years when we will not have or may shorten a clamming season or a crab season. That would still continue to fund the programs in Department of Ag for toxicity testing of shellfish in the state of Oregon. That concludes my presentation. I did attach a copy of our legislative concepts for your review, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Representative Byer, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, on the shellfish, since that was a new program, and you did answer the question about whether it was up to expectations or not, was the rollout pretty smooth? Were there a lot of complaints or...
Chair Smith, Representative Byer, we received a few complaints around the date of January 1, when the program was implemented. We've heard a few complaints throughout the summer, but relatively minor compared to the number of people who are engaged in the activity. I think, as was demonstrated by people testifying in favor of that program in the 03 session, the public's been accepting the program and the requirement for the license. Knowing, when you stop to think about it, that the money goes towards funding toxicity testing to ensure the safety of consumption of that shellfish in Oregon, as well as enforcement and management that will sustain that fishery for years to come. That spirit, I think, really gained a lot of acceptance by the public.
Just a follow on. One of the concerns that had been raised, and I don't know how you measure this, was that we had a lot of non-residents or Washington residents, I would guess, that were coming down because they had a fee up there and we didn't. Do we have any way of telling, you know, whether that's had a big effect or what effect it might be?
Chair Smith, representing Byer, you mean how many people continued to come to Oregon?
Well, and I see the number here, but we have no way of measuring in comparison because we had no license before, right?
But we couldn't compare how many residents were here prior to the license requirement just because there wasn't any requirement to monitor where people were from or how many Oregon residents participated. We made an estimate that we would see about 100,000 licenses sold, and that estimate was taken by our economist Chris Carter at the time in reviewing what had been occurring in other states and what we knew, what little we knew about participation in this state. We exceeded that by about 30,000 licenses, which was a bit of a surprise to us. We did not think that we would sell that many. However, we also have to reflect back on opportunity this last year. The Clatsop beaches were open. We had an excellent clam set on those beaches, which provide a lot of opportunity for harvest. And we also have one of the largest crab populations in many, many years. We have seen sport harvest and commercial harvest of crab reach record numbers this last year. So it could be that people are recognizing the abundance of the crab and clams both, and maybe we've seen kind of a bump in sales where we won't see that next year or the year after.
Thank you very much. Representative
Bokus, yes, Madam Chair, I have two questions.
Sure.
One for Mr. Ball and then a follow-up for you,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Ball, it's kind of a cross-committee, but it has an impact to this committee. I serve on veterans also, and I heard in a meeting in the last couple of days that that the governor, who speaks with one voice, is considering, or your department is considering, giving current serving military a free hunting and fishing license or combination license. Are you familiar with that, or can you enlighten the committee on that issue?
You get to go first.
Chair Smith, Representative Boquist, a couple of things. As far as the free hunting license is concerned, that program is being administered from the military department. They have an interest in seeing that program moves forward. How they have approached us with that is that the guards person would buy a license and then they would be reimbursed through the military department for that license. What we are doing internally in this agency is that when a member of the National Guard or other armed services is deployed, oftentimes their deployment interferes with their opportunity to participate in a hunt. What we have going before the commission on February 11th is a proposal to consider reinstating preference points for controlled hunt tags that those people would lose as a result of obtaining a tag and not being able to participate in the hunt. In addition to that, we're also proposing that the commission look at reinstating preference points if a person is deployed and cannot participate in the hunt after 2 years. They lose all preference points, and we are proposing that the commission consider restoring and keeping those preference points on file for that individual. With respect to the free license program, that truly is a program that's under the military department, and I refer to Lieutenant Colonel Mike Caldwell for that part.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My follow-up question to you, and it's just a point of clarification, so I understand the procedure being the freshman here. I have some serious, or actually all members of five counties that I represent have some serious concerns on the wolf management plan, specifically issues of livestock protection, rancher land over liability, cost impacts, so on and so forth like that. I'm aware that two other representatives are sponsoring a forum or something along that for educating purposes. Is that a topic given the situation we'll take up later, Madam Chair, or should I fire away now? Given the time and the list, firing away now might not be prudent, Madam Chair.
Oh, that was an easy question. I was just going to ask the director to kind of give us an update on the wolf management plan. So maybe why don't we just give us a quick where we're at in the process. I know you're going to have public hearings on February 10th. Are you going to make a decision on February 11th, and how is the legislature going to play in that? And I think that's going to maybe answer your question and a few others. And we'll take the time.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
Chair Smith, Representative Boquist. Let me start by saying wolves are coming to Oregon. The experimental population that was reintroduced by the Fish and Wildlife Service in the states of Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho have prospered. We started looking at this in 2001, shortly after I became the director. At that time, the agency had taken a position that there would be no wolves in Oregon, that those wolves would be taken back outside the state. I recognized that policy was in violation of state law and advised the commission that the position they had taken prior had been in violation of our statutes. The statutes require us to manage the wolf. And also, knowing the law fairly well, I recognized that the state ESA, with respect to protection of the gray wolf, was more restrictive than the federal ESA and the provisions under the federal ESA that would allow lethal take of wolves. Simply in Oregon, if a livestock owner was to observe a wolf killing his or her livestock and killed the wolf, they would be in violation of the state ESA. Now, I didn't think that that was particularly appropriate. And so we started a process to develop a wolf conservation management plan that could provide lethal take and allow people to protect their livestock. But we have to have a plan. That's very clearly outlined in the state statute. So, consequently, the first thing we did was to hold informational briefings for the Fish and Wildlife Commission. We held four of those and invited 29 speakers to come and speak to the commission on wolf management as it has been experienced in Wisconsin, Michigan, Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. Shortly after that, we held 14 town hall meetings around the state. We attracted over 2,000 participants, which quite frankly has been the largest public participation in any fish or wildlife management proposal that we've ever seen. It's phenomenal. I like public participation. If there's anything about this job I enjoy more, it's watching the public become engaged in an issue. I think that's where we get the best answers. So I was quite pleased with the turnout from the public on this subject. After the town hall meetings, the commission appointed a 14-member Wolf Advisory Committee that met for about a year. Last October, they submitted a proposed conservation wolf management plan to the commission for consideration. There have been public hearings on that wolf management plan since that time, and we continue to pick up more public comment as the commission deliberates over the elements of that conservation plan. We are scheduled February 10th in Troutdale to continue the public hearing on the wolf conservation plan, and the commission anticipates final rulemaking on that plan February 11th. We are on schedule, and I hope the participation by the public continues.
Will that hearing or your decision on February 11th then take into account the legislative action that's required?
Chair Smith, we anticipate if the commission adopts the plan as it's currently written or makes some adjustments to it, there will be a need to have three statutory changes in support of the plan. One would be a compensation program for landowners who lose livestock as a result of wolves. A second would be a status under the game mammal statute, a special status for wolves that identifies the wolf in the game mammal status as a special animal in the state of Oregon. The third would be a change in a statute that would include the wolf, so the wolf could be lethally taken on private property or public property under the confines set forth in the management plan, which has yet to be determined by the commission. Now, those are anticipated statutory changes. The commission has not ruled on the management plan, so I hope everyone can understand that those are speculated changes. They are not cast in stone, so to speak, at this time.
So they could adopt the plan on February 11th without these, and maybe not address this legislative session.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, they could adopt the plan.
Okay.
And I think from every indication I've gotten from the chair, the intention is to adopt the plan February 11th. And then there will be a request for legislative changes after that.
But you don't know that there'll be this session, the changes.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, I anticipate this session.
Okay. I guess I have one other question. How much money has the department already spent on this program? Do you have any idea?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, the expenses on the wolf management plan to date have been charged to a federal account that comes to us through the State Wildlife Grants Program through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I can't tell you the exact amount that has been spent at this time, but I can sure get that for you.
That would be great. Any other questions? Representative Boquist?
I believe Representative Burley was first.
Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure.
Just to clarify, you said the state ESA is more restrictive than the State Endangered Species Act is more restrictive than the Federal Endangered Species Act. And I'm presuming that was in reference to the issue of lethal take. And I'm curious why under the federal ESA we can take them. Is it because of the experimental population status or what?
Chair Smith, Representative Burley. The state ESA is more restrictive with respect to lethal take than the federal ESA, and that pertains to the take of the wolf as it relates to harming livestock. The federal ESA has certain provisions under the experimental population designation within the boundary of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, and that boundary does not include Oregon. So we fall under the strict jurisdiction of the federal ESA as it relates to 40, Section 10, Section 6, Section 7. And currently, under that designation, outside the experimental boundary, that's where the state ESA becomes more restrictive than the federal ESA.
Follow up?
Yes.
I'm still confused because since Oregon is not inside the boundary of the experimental population, then the wolf doesn't have the same benefits of an experimental status. It would seem to me it's either going to have the same take restrictions as either a threatened or endangered status.
Chair Smith, Representative Burley, there are more liberal exceptions under the experimental boundary designation than there is outside.
Would you repeat that, please?
Chair Smith, Representative Burley, inside the experimental boundary under the federal designation, there are more liberal opportunities for lethal harvest than outside.
Well,
the experimental boundary.
I believe that was my point. Oregon's outside the boundary, correct?
Yes.
So we don't enjoy those liberal deviations on take, if you will. If it's outside the boundary, we can't take it under the federal ESA, can we?
Chair Smith, Representative Burley, that is correct.
Yes.
But however, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service can write provisions to allow that take.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Douglas?
Madam Chair, unfortunately, it raises more questions than it does
answers.
Sure. Especially in my case, Madam Chair. But I guess my question at this point to Mr. Paul is that I think what you said, and I raised, and you heard the question of the chair previously, was, I mean, livestock protection, rancher landowner liability, so on and so forth. That I think what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that you are, that if you pass this, the management plan, that then those issues I raised, livestock protection, rancher landowner liability, would only be covered if we change the statutes in the state of Oregon. That we fix those if we change the statutes this session. Is that what you're saying, Mr. Paul?
Chair Smith, Representative Boquist, I don't know if I'm quite following you, but so let me kind of go back over the state ESA. The state ESA, without a management plan, prohibits the lethal take of wolves if the person is protecting their livestock. In other words, today, under current law, if I see a wolf killing my sheep or cattle, I cannot kill the wolf without being in violation of law. If a wolf management conservation plan is put in place and is adopted by the commission, and the conservation management plan ensures that the species will be sustained in the state, you can write a provision into the plan that provides for lethal take of the wolf when it's preying on livestock. That is written into the state ESA, not the federal ESA.
Right.
And that's where there's a lot of confusion, the federal ESA and the state ESA and their overlap, and where one may allow something the other may not.
Madam Chair, if I may follow up.
Sure.
You specifically stated there were three things that need to be done once that management plan, if it were adopted, three items would have to be addressed in the legislature. One item was the compensation issue. Two item was some sort of tinkering or whatever with lethal take, right?
Status,
right?
Right.
And then the third one, wolf status, right?
Right.
And then the other one was, you know, defining lethal, and you used the word lethal take. So I guess I'm still back at my same question. Of those three items that have to be changed, they would literally have to be changed in statute this session by the legislature to protect ranchers or farmers if they did a lethal take, am I correct? Or and compensation. Because you're saying we have to do three things to make the plan work. Compensation, lethal take, and stats. Now, if we don't have those three things, then we're back at square one where I just raised the issue of, you know, what is the livestock protection? How do we protect livestock? And what is the legal liability against the landowner or the rancher? We have to have those three takes in order to cover, if it were adopted, livestock protection and cover liability or take. Is that correct?
Chair Smith, Representative Boquist, let me back up. We probably should walk through these one at a time. The compensation plan is to compensate people for loss of livestock due to wolves. The change in game mammal status as a special animal under the game mammal statute allows flexibility within the Department of Fish and Wildlife to use a whole array of tools to manage wolves in Oregon. The issue with respect to lethal take, currently, that statute that we need to get into to add wolves to currently has cougar and bear. We have to add wolf to that statute so that wolves will have the same status as the cougar and bear with respect to lethal take.
Same thing, Madam Chair.
Representative Sumner had a question, and I'll believe it. We need to move on, but yeah.
Would you rather I skip?
No.
Madam Chair, Mr. Paul, thank you for being here. And from a family of hunters and fishermen and a community of hunters and fishermen, almost universally, we view the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife as a success story in government. A department in the state that is actually doing the job and doing it well for a good price. Having said that, sir, a number of people I've talked to are intrigued, at least, about the insistence almost of reintroducing extinct species. We've talked about the wolf, the mountain goats in Columbia River Gorge. They're wondering what is the financial outcome of that, and what is the purpose in the first place? Secondly, a number of people are concerned about the burgeoning population of mountain lions. Talk to farmers in southeast portion of the state who have lost half of their calf crop, telling me that represents half of their income for the year. No possible way to chase those lions down or to control them in any manner. Are you, sir, working within the department to find a way to control that population and predation by the lions?
Chair Smith, Representative Sumner, you had about three questions there.
Yes, sir.
So let's take the issue of cougar and what we are being able, what we can do with cougar and the harvest of cougar. We since the late 60s, when the cougar was made a game mammal, we started to intensely manage the cougar. There were very few cougars that existed in the state at that time. They had been a predator up until that point. In 1995, with the passage of Measure 18, which was an initiative petition before the public, it was voted on that the use of dogs and bait was prohibited activities for the harvest of bear and cougar. That was voted on by the public a second time and was voted quite overwhelmingly after the first time. And so consequently, we have not been able to use hounds to harvest cougar and bear in this state. Hounds have been the most efficient tool used to harvest bear and cougar. With that, we reduced the cost of a cougar tag. It was up around $50. We reduced that cost down to $10, I believe, today. We saw an increase in the sale of cougar tags. We included the sale of cougar tags in with a sport pack, which is a economical way of buying your licenses and all your tags at a reduced price. So we have lots of opportunities for people to obtain those tags at a value less than what it was originally. We have seen harvest of those of cougar on an allocated basis, reaching the allocation point in some instances in different regions. We expand the season to a 10-month season from 2 to 3 months. We are currently, with the tools that we have moved about as far and about as liberal as we can to provide people opportunities to harvest cougar. The population continues to grow. I've said many times that in modern-day fish and wildlife management, we have more cougar and bear in the state of Oregon than ever before. That's the case.
I think we'd agree with you.
We are currently, with information that we have developed here in this state, along with research that's been conducted outside the state that we can apply to, we are looking at population dynamics within the cougar population in Oregon and are revising our population models to more accurately reflect the population size in Oregon. The more we know about cougar and the more we know about their range, the better we can do in identifying a specific number in the population. That will be done early summer, I would say, and at that time you may see a revision in some of the allocation for cougars in the state of Oregon. But we have some more work to do on that yet.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much. I'm going to have to move on, but I think what we're going to do is have you come back.
I'll come back anytime. And I certainly will afford everyone any opportunity in your offices.
And that's great. And I think today was intended to introduce and kind of, you know, touch base on these issues. And as you can see, there's great interest in those issues. And I'm sure we will continue that. Question?
Madam Chair, just one more thing. Mr. Ball did, in fact, brief me and told me everything that he told me this morning at a previous date, and all I did was ask, and he's very, very helpful.
Oh, yeah.
I appreciate it. I just wanted the rest of the committee to take care of that, Mr. Ball. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do you have anything to add to that?
As it was mentioned earlier, we have the opportunity to speak with the Republican caucus on Tuesday the 25th. I certainly hope that people take advantage of that opportunity. If you can't be there, give me a call. We'll set up another time where I'll bring myself or the staff will come to present the whole issue of wolves.
Thank
or cougar or bear.
Yeah. Thank you very much. We're going to move on. Tim Woods, Director of State Parks. Oh, I'm sorry. I called you out of order, but we can do either. Yeah. Dan? Or Marvin Brown, we had State Foresters. So do you want to? Okay. I can't read it. Sorry.
That's okay.
We got so interested in wolves. Critters, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Marvin Brown. I'm the director of the Department of Forestry. Dan Postrell's with me. I'm going to try to do all the talking, but he'll back me up if we need him.
Okay.
What I'd like to do is refer you to two different pieces of material that we've provided. The first is this big weightlifter's book here. And within that is a lot of really good information that deals with a lot of the issues in forestry in Oregon today. I'm not going to talk about that. It's just a resource that we hope you'll find useful. And if it prompts any questions, I hope you'll give us a call to come talk to you about anything that's in there. The other item that I refer you to is what I'm going to talk from today, this piece of paper.
Okay.
And I'll just jump right into that.
If you would. Thank you.
What I want to try to cover as quickly as I can is just give you some scope of the agency, size, how we're structured, the programs that we deal with, and then spend some time talking about really what kind of value we try to deliver to the state of Oregon. And in delivering that value, you run into a lot of issues that relate to added cost, if you would, barriers to being able to deliver services. And I want to talk a little bit about some of those issues that crop up. And because basically, whenever we try to improve the program, that's what we're dealing with, those issues that affect cost and barriers to program delivery. If you look at page 3, this is where I'm starting the meat of the presentation. Our biennial budget during the last biennium was $226 million. We have about 700 permanent full-time positions. We also have about 700 seasonal positions, mostly related to fire protection. On page 4, we break out the funding. It's about 15% general funds, at 8% federal funds, and then the bulk of our revenue, 77%, comes from a variety of other sources, landowner assessments, timber harvest tax, revenue from timber sales on forest land that we owned, and so forth. On page 5, we start to get into what the programs are that we implement. On the left-hand side there are our four primary programs that we deliver: protection from fire. And if you look down at the pie chart at the bottom of the page, you'll see protection from fire is by far our largest program. It's about 45% of our total effort. State forest represents about 25%. That is the forests that are owned by the state that we manage. Private forest management and assistance to landowners and implementation of the Forest Practices Act is about 10% of our effort. And urban community forestry is just a sliver, about less than 1% at this point. And then we've also listed, relative to those programs, where we're at on some other efforts within the department, administrative operation of the state nursery and so forth. Page 6 is our organizational chart. We have an assistant state forester in charge of each of the major program divisions: fire, state forest, and private forest. We have an associate state forester who handles administrative affairs and is also authorized to act on my behalf when needed. Our agency affairs director, Dan Postrell, who's with me, is the person who coordinates our legislative issues as well as supervises public affairs. And then there are three area directors who are responsible for supervising our field functions, and they also report to me. Like I said, what I want to do is look at each program just a little bit and talk about the values that we create in those programs and really what are the issues that we're trying to deal with on a daily basis to keep costs manageable, to deal with costs that are added to that program and, if you would, barriers to delivering good value. You all, I believe, earlier this week, received a presentation from our fire chief, Tim Keith. And as I said, fire is our largest program. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on this page because I suspect he did a really good job of giving you background there, and we can skip that unless you've got some specific questions on fire. Page 9 is the state-owned forest management program. We, there's a lot of perceptions about what the department and owns. It's actually a fairly small percentage of the state forest and land, 750,000 acres. That's less than 3%, I believe, of the whole state. There's in the neighborhood of 28 million acres of forest land in the state, so we don't really own all that much. Out of that land, we returned to counties and schools $63+ million last year. That was a clear revenue to them. We focus a lot on creating the right kind of plant and animal habitats. We have recreation programs on all of our lands. It's important. Our lands do represent an important source of raw materials to industry in those areas where they occur. We have education programs where we're constantly trying to educate the public about the benefits of forestry and forest management through what we do on our lands. And all of that, I think, helps with the community viability in areas where we have our property. The issues that we deal with daily in state forest management. It's not going to be a surprise to anybody that conflict over opinions and views and values about how public lands get managed is a huge part of what we pay attention to regularly. It is a staff cost. It is a time cost. But it's something that we have to do simply by nature of being public land managers. And going with that is a much higher level of accountability that we pay for in order to as one of the key parts of managing that conflict. In addition, markets are certainly important. If timber prices are down, then our revenues are down, our ability to manage is down, and the values we deliver are down, so markets become an important part. And we're constantly looking for better ways to implement the program through contracting, and that's something that we work on all the time. You get to a point there where contracting is not effective when you manage land if you don't have individuals working for you who know what's out there, though. So it's an issue that we have to manage pretty carefully. On page 10 is private forest management. By working with private landowners, we feel like we're protecting the interest that the state has in a viable, economically viable, working private forest estate. That's really what we try to do. We try to do that by working with landowners to help them implement the requirements of the Forest Practices Act. We try to approach that from, you know, in a partnership assistance standpoint more than a regulatory standpoint. How can we help you be successful? But the Forest Practices Act is there because there's a recognition that we do need to protect some key environmental values such as water quality. And so we concentrate pretty heavily on making sure that in the process of keeping private forests working and economically viable, we're also doing a good job of protecting those environmental amenities. We work a lot with landowners to help them realize what they want to do on their land effectively. The issues that we're constantly trying to grapple with, the compliance costs for a landowner, anytime the costs to a landowner go up, then you put that land under pressure to become something other than a working forest in the future. So compliance costs and making sure that we're always dealing with landowner needs and values is really important. By that same token, we would like to there's ways to capture more value on private lands, and, such as carbon sequestration and kind of some new things that are out there we don't have viable programs for now. It would be nice to be able to do that someday. Jump down to the very last line. There is trends of changing land ownership in the state of Oregon. Don't know exactly what all that means at this point, but integrated forest companies are more and more frequently selling their land to specific timber management organizations who have a little more favorable cost structure for owning that land. So the companies that own mills and paper mills, sawmills are becoming less and less likely to also own forest land in the state. There's also more pressure for lands to be sold to that were typically industrial lands, particularly in the eastern part of Oregon, that those lands are changing now into more private ownership. And in some cases, there's a threat of them being taken out of a working forest kind of condition. Page 11 is urban and community forestry. It's not a big program for our agency. Like I said, it represents less than 1% of our total effort. But I wanted to highlight that because I think it's something that we need to recognize is more important in the future. I mentioned here that as an issue, right now we don't recognize urban forestry as an investment. And to me, it very much is an investment because so much of the conflict that we're trying to manage arises out of differences in perceptions between urban populations and rural populations about what is the value of resource management and utilizing resources. And the only way that we're going to be able to carry on a construction constructive conversation with folks in the urban areas as if we're there and we're doing things and we're connected to them. And to me, you know, an urban forestry program is that investment to be able to do that. I know, you know, we're not going to be pushing for great growth in that program during this biennium, but it's kind of a personal goal of mine to keep laying the groundwork to see that program become a good investment in communication and connection between urban and rural interests over time. Paige?
Quick question.
Yes, ma'am.
What do you consider an urban forest?
Typically, anything that falls within a heavily populated area, Madam Chair, would fall under an urban forestry program.
Parcel size?
It could be. I think there's opportunities for us to have a more deliberate program working with those fringe areas where rural lands are becoming more and more intermixed with residential properties. I think we would be better served managing the issues on those lands from an urban forestry perspective and letting our more traditional rural foresters focus on the big properties and the more traditional forestry issues. That's one thing we don't have the ability to do right now.
What would be an example of a difference in how you manage it?
A really good example. I was out with some of our private land foresters several months ago up in Washington County, which is a fringe of Portland, and becoming more and more of that rural-urban interface. And we were looking at a piece of property where the landowner had initiated a timber sale. And the follow-up work to reforest that property, which is required by law, mm-hmm. simply was not adequate. And the question that our foresters were asking me was, how much time should we spend on this? Because the chances are really good that was the last timber sale that's ever going to occur on that piece of property based on the development patterns that you can see moving out there. And right now we really don't have a focused program to deal with those kind of issues.
Okay. Thanks for the question.
The page 12 just talks about some of the areas and issues that we deal with just from a broad administrative standpoint. One of the I just highlight two of those. One is succession management. It's kind of a common phenomenon across forestry agencies everywhere in the country that there's we're experiencing a large turnover in individuals in this business that are reaching retirement age and moving on. And it's a real challenge to figure out how we're going to continue to staff leadership positions with an accelerated rate of turnover like we're experiencing and anticipate for the future. You know, it takes a seasoned, highly skilled individual, for example, to be an incident commander on a 100,000-acre fire. And it takes years of experience and training and qualifications for a person to get to that point. And when we start taking out large groups of people because of age class, it just becomes a significant challenge to get there. So, and it's one that we're trying to deal with. The other one that I would highlight is business systems and management processes. And one of the conclusions I've reached since I've been the director for the last year and a half is that we could make a lot of gains in that area with some smart investments. The way that we manage transactions, the way that our different business databases actually don't talk to each other right now. There's a lot of issues there that are a problem. And I think, again, if we could recognize that those are investments that save costs and improve efficiency down the road, I really would like to get to that point. That's a very quick overview. Ask any questions. Any one of those issues is, you know, a whole day of discussion, and I'd be happy to do that at some other time with some other forum or whatever. So.
Thank you. You must have just done a wonderful job. Do you have a question? No.
No.
Okay.
I've heard much of this before.
I'm sure.
But they do an exceptionally good job of educating small women.
I know they do. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you.
We look forward to having you in front of us again.
Sure. I will too.
Thank you.
If they're all this easy, I'll look forward to it.
Yeah.
You're not with Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah. Uh-oh.
got wolves.
Yeah, Tim Woods. I'm sorry for saying that before. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's my pleasure to have the opportunity to give you a brief overview of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. For the record, my name is Tim Wood. I'm the director of the department, and I look forward to working with you throughout this session. If there are any issues regarding budget issues or bills that we may have in this session that would come before you. And like my predecessors, I would look forward to meeting with you individually to answer questions or in some other forum if you have issues that you would like to have addressed.
Well, I just first want to thank you for being so responsive on my issue in my district. So thank you for...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That works out.
So do I.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you.
Very quickly, I will take you through this broad overview. Authority for our department resides in a couple of articles of the Oregon Constitution, two chapters of revised statutes and portions of two others, and we also promulgate rules, administrative rules, through Chapter 36. The mission of our department is to protect and provide outstanding natural, scenic, cultural, historic, and recreational sites for the enjoyment and the education of the current and future generations. To do that, the department was organized as a separate department in 1989. Prior to that, it had been a division of ODOT. And in 1989, the department became established as a separate organization, and the Oregon Parks Recreation Commission was established to carry out the responsibilities. We have seven commissioners on our commission. They are appointed or nominated by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. Five of those commissioners represent the five congressional districts in the state, and two are at large. One of the at-large representatives represents areas east of the Cascades, and one is essentially a coastal representative, represents the areas west of the Cascades. We have one position currently vacant. Our commission has a responsibility for setting department policy. They also have responsibility for adopting administrative rules pertaining to operations of the department, and they also provide budget guidance and budget oversight and in development of our budget and expenditure of our funds. They meet about every 7 weeks or so, about five to six times a year, in locations around the state. On the next page is a roadmap, if you will. Maybe it wouldn't be too good to try to follow it, but it is a roadmap of how we are organized. Again, as I pointed out, the governor makes the appointment of our seven members of the commission, and the commission has the authority to hire and fire the director. In addition to being responsible as the director of the Department of Parks and Recreation, I also have the responsibility in statute to be the State Historic Preservation Officer. So in statute, the director of the Parks and Recreation Department is also the State Historic Preservation Officer. We have numerous committees and advisory councils that we work with, and they're listed there on the chart. Organizationally, to kind of deliver the services, we're divided into three major divisions: the operations division, the administration division, and the heritage conservation division. And I'll talk briefly about what each of those do in a minute or two. We have 500 in the current budget, the 03-05 budget. We have 524 FTE, which really equates to about 700 plus employees when we bring on our seasonals and our temporary employees for summer operations. There is one benchmark specifically related to the department in the Oregon benchmarks, and that is relates to the number of acres of park property available per thousand citizens. That's a tough one to reach, but we have also other performance measures in our budget that help us promote and measure our ability to accomplish our mission. Our commission 4 years ago adopted a strategic plan or strategic vision to the department that is called Target 2014. The eight major goals of Target 2014 are laid out here, and I can provide you copies of this. I I inadvertently didn't remember to bring them this morning. But this is, provides a broad overview of the direction of the department, the goals that our commission would like to achieve from now through the year 2014. This provides the basis for business decisions and programming decisions, budget decisions, and budget development within the department. At the portion of the page that talks to programs, as I mentioned before, we're organized into three major divisions. We have the operations division, which is principally the division that manages our 230-some parks and approximately 95,000 acres of property that we manage in the field. They're also responsible for delivery services to our visitors and working with other agencies in cooperative agreements and ways of managing properties and delivering recreation services. Again, this is about 80% of our budget. About 80% of our personnel is managed out of the operations division. And our operations division manager is Dave Wright, who's been with the department for a long time and recently has assumed the role of assistant director. The administration division is administered by Janet Tindall, assistant director. In the administration division, we have, in general, the business functions of the department, our financial services, accounting, contracting, personnel safety services, things like public information services in our reservation section. But one of the key elements of the administration division is our grants program. We have a significant grants program where we make grants to local communities and other recreation service providers through funding that's either provided federally through the Land and Water Conservation Fund to counties through the recreational vehicle registration fee revenue that we receive, and through the ATV, all-terrain vehicle program, and through our local grants program. Our local grants program in this biennium is an $8 million program that we administer to provide grants to local cities, counties, and special districts, other jurisdictions for providing, developing recreation facilities in local communities. The Heritage Conservation Division is essentially the division established to carry out the state's responsibilities under a federal National Historic Preservation Act, and it's primarily a large portion of the funding for carrying out this is provided through federal funds. This is a national register program for registering properties on the National Historic Register, preservation of historic properties, and tax incentive programs, our Pioneer Cemetery program, and so forth. I would just mention that to kind of put in perspective the size of our operation, we provide services annually to over 38 million day-use visitors, which ranks fifth highest nationally among all 50 state park systems, and about 2.5 million camper nights, which again ranks very high, about eighth in the nation. The sentence there points out that when judged based on the number of visitors per acre, our system ranks even higher, and in that case we're second in the nation in respect to the number of visitors we have per acre at about 413, and the national average is 84. I would refer you back to the Oregon benchmark, which was the number of acres provided per 1,000 population. We either have to quit growing the population, reduce the population, or buy a lot more property to make progress in that Oregon benchmark 90, and the fact that we are second in the nation with 413 visitors per acre is a real indicator of that. On the next page, there's two pie charts. I'd like to direct your attention very quickly to the top one, which looks at the revenue that comes from the department. Our revenue is projected for 0507 in our 0507 budget request, total $194 million. And primarily, the interesting part here, I think, is the sources of funds. About 36% of that funding comes from the Parks and Natural Resources Fund, which is the lottery-based fund, which was established as a result of Measure 66 passed in 19. 1998. Those are dedicated funds to the department. Additionally, it's made up of user fees, a portion of fees for registering recreational vehicles. Those fees come to our department, and a portion of that is further distributed to county park systems for grants, and some of it is a direct sort of an entitlement program to county park systems to help them maintain and operate their systems. We have money that comes to us from the RV or from the OHV or all-terrain vehicle registration program. If you register an RV, that money comes into our department, as well as a portion of the unrefunded gas tax. So we manage the state's OHV or ATV program. We also have some transfers from ODOT, but probably most significantly here is you'll see that there is no general fund in our budget at all. Our 0507 estimated expenditures essentially is our budget request for $166 million in the coming biennium, and that will support some major development as we continue to develop Harris Canyon State Park in Washington County, some money for development and improvements at newly acquired Thompson's Mills, development at Fort Yamhill, development of a new site at Crissy Field, which is on the border of the Oregon-California border, right near Highway 101, just west of Highway 101. It will increase our facility investment program from $15 million to $21 million. This is a program that was established back in the 97-99 biennium with a $15 million lottery bond to help us build down the backlog and bring our infrastructure of our facilities and our facilities up to a good standard. And we're making significant progress on that. In 97, that backlog was estimated to be about $110 million, and today we have it worked down to about $53 million. So we're making good progress there. It also increases our local grants program, which was established at $5 million, increases it to $8 million in the next biennium. Again, that's a very popular program with communities and other recreation providers because it helps them meet recreation needs locally. Sort of the key issues or key items in our budget this year, as I mentioned, our facilities investment program, we're looking to increase that from $15 to $21 million to continue our progress in improving and developing our park system. And as well as the local grant program, the increase in the local grant program, which I mentioned, to continue to acquire properties, to build a system, to preserve and protect resources, as well as to meet future needs. And programs in heritage conservation to find ways to help the state maintain and its citizens maintain connections with its past and with its history. A significant part of this will be some funding for planning for the Oregon Sesquicentennial, which was done through the Oregon Heritage Commission, which is administered through our department. And finally, on the back page, and I won't address each of these, but I just summarized for you the legislative concepts that we had before this session, and the bills are noted there. Most of these bills are sort of housekeeping measures and no real significant program changes in any of these. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. 30 seconds. Representative Burley.
Director Wood, yeah. Having served 5 years on the Bend Metro Park and Recreation District Board of Directors, I want to express our gratitude for the opportunity to receive some of these local government grants. It's done a lot for our city and folks that really appreciate that.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, thank you very much. We appreciate that.
Gee, that was quick and nice. Any other questions? I just had a quick question. Can you do something about my constituent complaints about no restrooms in the National Scenic Area?
I'm sorry, about?
No restroom facilities without paying to go into a state park.
Oh, Madam Chair, we have many places in the gorge, parks that we operate that aren't.
Right, but don't they all have, they use fees, $3 fees?
Madam Chair, no, they don't. Rooster Rock does.
Okay.
Dabney does. Lewis and Clark does not. Coburg does not. Starvation Creek does not. So just quickly, those are the ones that come to mind. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. That gives me an answer.
Sure. Now you know where to stop.
I know, yeah. I do know where to stop. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have six kids and drive that route to our ranch. Oh. I can give you a location.
That would be great. Thank you very much. Okay. I give that call a lot. We have one final testifier, Mike Greeney, the director of the Office Department of Oregon Department of Energy. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think I'm getting hungry. I'm getting hungry. So.
Last but not least, right?
Last but not least. And if short would be great, but thank you.
We're all under time.
No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Mike Graney. I'm Director of the Oregon Department of Energy, and I will be very brief. I've got some materials there that you can read at your leisure. Give you more background on what we do, including the last few pages are examples we've tried to do by county for the counties you represent of some of the activities and projects that we're working with schools and businesses and hospitals and others to save energy and develop renewable energy. I want to back up briefly. Energy is critical to our economy. A good supply of energy at an affordable price is really crucial to our economy. And I want to take you back to the energy crisis that we had 2000 and 2001 as kind of a starting point for a brief discussion of what we do in terms of siting large energy facilities, promoting conservation and renewables, our other missions. At that time, we had a combination of bad events coming together. There was we were in a low water year in terms of the Columbia River hydroelectric system. It was about half of its peak levels in terms of the power that was being produced. We also had severe price spikes, natural gas prices throughout the West. Eventually, was found to be in part market manipulation. There were shortages in California and concerns about shortages and potential blackouts here in the Northwest as well, which we were able to avoid. But we had severe impacts on businesses. Thousands of people lost their jobs as industries that were heavy users of energy had to shut down because of the high cost of energy. It was a very bad situation. The 2001 legislature, in response, made a number of changes that were followed up again in 2003 to put Oregon in a better situation if those events happen again. First, you changed the process of siting large energy facilities, making it quicker to site power plants and get them online when needed. Also provided additional incentives for individuals, businesses, and others to save energy so that our energy supplies go further, and when there are price spikes, that people are buffered somewhat from the shocks of those price increases by being able to use less energy for the energy functions that you need. There are also incentives to encourage greater use of renewable energy, and in addition to a number of other benefits that it has, it diversifies our energy resources and has no fuel costs. So those were all important things. And I want to just briefly mention some of the results. Our supply situation has improved. 2,200 megawatts, 11 power plants have been operating since 2001 that were in the licensing process prior to then, but they all came online. They're operating now in Oregon. We've had four good, if not great, hydroelectric years, certainly better than what we had in 2000-2001. Our siting council, it's a citizens panel that actually makes the siting decisions, and we provide staffing to that siting council. Since 2001, has approved 16 more power plants with over 3,400 megawatts of electricity. Of that, 200 megawatts of wind and cogeneration are already operating. PGE recently broke ground on a 600-megawatt facility at Port Westward, and the Siting Council recently approved another 1,000 megawatts at Klamath Falls, which we expect construction to start soon. So our power supply situation has improved. The energy efficiency and energy savings efforts have also improved. Let me just give you a couple of examples. In 2001, 20,000 individuals used our residential tax credit for energy-efficient appliances, hybrid vehicles, and solar space and hot water systems. This year, the number was 37,000, almost double. For businesses, businesses using the business energy tax credit also doubled from 1,000 businesses in 2001, which was a record year at the time, to 2,000 this year. We've had similar increased efforts in energy conservation in terms of working with schools, such as designing new schools like the middle school in the Dalles that the chairman was at with me at the dedication, and other schools around the state, to make those schools more energy efficient, to be able to use a fourth to a third less energy each year. On renewable energy, we have the largest wind farm in the country on the Oregon-Washington border, north of Umatilla, and it's been expanded twice. Other wind farms in Oregon are also being expanded. And we have in Salem here the largest food processor in the country, the Kettle Chips installation in terms of solar energy. It's the largest solar application of the food industry anywhere in the country, and it's the largest solar system in the Northwest. And it even in weather like this, cloudy or rainy weather, that produces up to a third of their energy, meets their energy needs. We also have been developing over this last year with broad-based public input what's called a renewable energy action plan for ways that state agencies can encourage renewable energy more, measures that individuals and businesses can take, and some possible legislation, of which I a list of three bills I've included in your materials there that we can come back and visit later. One other outcome of 2001 was price overcharge investigations. So we worked with the Attorney General's office, provided them the technical support for investigating collusions in the market, and it was a multi-state effort. And 2 years ago, there was a settlement with the Williams Company, which is a major natural gas wholesaler, that returned $15 million to Oregon. And half of that money went directly to individual ratepayers on their bills. Almost $6 million went to low-income programs, low-income weatherization and energy heating assistance. And about $1 million we've used for working directly with schools, and we've been working with schools that are not eligible for the Senate Bill 1149 public purpose charge funding. So we've been trying to deal with schools throughout the state, and included some examples in your materials there. There's other cases pending, potentially the Duke and El Paso cases that you may hear about more this session could bring in another $5 to $10 million, depending on the terms of those settlements. They're a little further off in terms of timing, and we're not entirely sure when that will occur. Let me mention one other thing briefly. Since 9/11, we've been much more active on security issues. We've worked closely with the energy facilities themselves in terms of their security needs. We also work with the network of federal and state officials on security issues generally. I've increased our own capacity to respond to an energy emergency, whether it's caused by bad weather conditions, an accident, or potential terrorism. We also, as part of our responsibility, regulate the shipments of nuclear waste to the state. And we've had over 300 shipments this year. Most of them, two, are from Hanford. And While many of those are low-level waste, some are not, and there's we've worked closely with the federal government to increase security and safety and have trained emergency responders along the routes to be able to respond in the event of accidents. We've also continued our efforts on Hanford cleanup. Hanford is it's outside the state of Oregon. It's the Federal Department of Energy facility near the Tri-Cities. It's on the Columbia River. It presents significant risks to Oregon, and we continue our efforts there. And in the materials, I've included some highlights of some of the progress we've made and some of the issues that are still outstanding. And just briefly to wrap up, as a one-page summary of our budget, we have no general fund. Most of our money comes in the form of federal funds, and some of that is actually in the other fund category that you see because it will go through another entity first, such as National Governors Association or Western Governors Association, and comes to us as other funds. We are expecting an increase in that type of money that's reflected there. Our fees are down slightly in terms of what we expect to need to collect. The only significant increase, and it's the last item on the right-hand column of the budget where it talks about the higher education package, that would be, and then on the back side of that are examples of the projects at the different state university campuses. There's deferred maintenance that has been that needs to be addressed, and higher education, big part of that are the energy facilities, the heating cooling systems at the plants, at the campuses. We would upgrade and replace those using the bonds that we issue for our low interest loan program, and higher education would pay those loans back over time. We estimate using that $27 million of capacity there that those projects would save $4 to $5 million a year, and that's at current energy costs. So as energy costs are likely to rise, then that investment will pay off even sooner. That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions now or come back at your convenience.
Great. Are there any questions?
I just have one quick question, Madam Chair. The Hermiston Power Plant, Umatilla Generating Project, those are one and the same, are they not? Just change names, ownership?
No, there's actually there's two separate projects at Hermiston. There's the two-unit plant at the junction of I-82 and I-84, and then there's also, if you go on I-84 a mile further east, there's another two units. There were two units additionally approved at the first site, the I-82-I-84 junction, and that's on the list here where it says construction pending, but we've been the Umatilla Generating Project, there it says site certificate terminated. Recently, the developer decided not to go forward with that project. But there are four units at two different sites operating for a total of about 1,200 megawatts there.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much for being so patient, too.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm sure we'll be hearing you. Well, committee, that's it for the day. I will recess or adjourn until next Wednesday at 9. So with that, we're adjourned.